welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is March 3rd, 2026, and this is episode 586. I am the co-host Mark Ames in Western New York. We just actually had a lunar eclipse. I went out trying to find it. I got up at like 5:45, went to the backyard. There's too much forest here. We live in a forest, and the sun set on the wrong side. So I got in my car, drove to the highest point I could to see if I could catch the lunar eclipse, the blood moon, but it was already getting light out, and well, it didn't work out. But anyways.
The omens are clear enough. I don't think you even needed a blood moon.
I know. It's too appropriate. Yeah, you're listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe, please, and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warner. And as you heard, I'm online with John Dolan, a.k.a. The Warner, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Puglia. John, how you doing?
I'm good. Well, I mean, considering I'm actually kind of flinching at every new newscast, but I wanted to clarify one thing. I mentioned a poem about Harding, who is, to our foreign audience, an obscure and corrupt and mocked American president, kind of Trumpy.
Mm, Warren Harding, yeah.
Yeah, of the early 20th century. And this Midwestern poet, James Wright, had two poems on Harding. And this the ending is really beautiful, I think, and it could be an epitaph for this moment. So this is the end of the Harding poem. And Harding was a fool. Even his big pretentious stone lays him bare to ridicule. I know it, but don't look at me. By God, I didn't start this mess. Whatever sun and rain may be, the hearts of men are merciless.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Is Wright one of the better poets, or no?
Sometimes, mm-hmm. Yeah. He has this beautiful, beautiful poem. I mean, if you haven't felt like this poem, you haven't really got a heart. And it's one of those poems that just describes a bucolic scene. He's out in the backyard in the hammock, and there's what my wife is doing. There's what my kids are doing. The dog is running around. And then there's just this pause. And after a blank line, it goes, I have wasted my life.
Oh, that cuts a little too close to home. But we'll talk about that right now. So.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's get to our interview. We have a really good interview with Professor Robert Pape from the University of Chicago, who is a longtime expert on air power and the limits of air power. And so it's very relevant to what's going on today with the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. It's a really good conversation. We go historical and also into the current war and where it's going. And so I think you'll like it. Let's get to our interview. Okay, so we are really honored to have with us today a very timely guest for Radio Warner, Professor Robert Pape. He is professor of political science at the University of Chicago and founder director of the Chicago Project on Security and Threats, and author of Bombing to Win, Air Power and Coercion in War, and also the author of a new and extremely relevant Substack called The Escalation Trap. And he has been writing about, researching, lecturing on, and so on air power for 30 years. So there couldn't be a more relevant guest to what is going on today. So first of all, thank you for coming on the show, Robert.
I'm absolutely glad to be here, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah. So I guess the first question here is, how is the war? I guess I would say this. I mean, you write about how air power does not achieve political aims, well, particularly collapsing regimes. And you've also written about how the more precise weaponry has gotten, the more persuasive that argument is, in spite of examples in history up to recent times, that it continues to be more and more seductive as the weaponry gets better, but it doesn't produce the results. So I guess, first of all, looking at the current war, how would you fit this into what you've been writing about?
It's almost a perfect fit. President Trump is up against the weight of history, not just the weight of Iran. For over 100 years, states have been trying to topple regimes with air power alone. They've tried dozens and dozens of times. America's tried many, many times, the dumb bomb age, the smart bomb age. European states have tried it. Russia has tried it. And it has never, and I'm choosing my words carefully here, it has never worked in over 100 years. We don't have many patterns in international politics that are 100% consistent. Mm-hmm. So normally you hear quibble words like, well, it rarely would work, or virtually. This is really quite a striking 100% failure rate. Now, it doesn't fail for reasons you might think, like you can't hit the target. So the first thing, and I've been teaching about this for so many years, the first thing that people think is that, well, I'll tell you why it doesn't work. It's because we couldn't hit the target. Now that we can always hit the target, it's going to work. Well, that was a thought you could have 30 years ago. But the fact of the matter is, with smart bombs, precision weapons, they are virtually 100% tactically successful all the time. Now, if you have a big gale wind, that will throw them off. So, but mm-hmm. absent those circumstances, which we can work around, the truth is they are virtually 100% tactically successful. And you're seeing that in this case, in Iran, the opening wave was virtually 100% tactically successful, not just in hitting buildings, but in killing leaders. And then this is the mesmerizing part of the smart bomb trap, I call it. So within the escalation trap, there are specific traps. And I'm now writing the specific variant about the smart bomb trap in the different stages. And what you're seeing is that the smart bombs are so tactically successful, they kind of are mesmerizing. They narrow the focus of not just a military planner, but presidents who then are seeing these unbelievable presentations where four-star generals explaining that, yes, sir, 100% of these targets will, in fact, be 100% destroyed, or as Trump likes to say, obliterated. But tactical obliteration is not the same as strategic success. And that's what you face in the smart bomb trap. And that's what you are seeing unfold in real time as we speak. It's the failure, the strategic failure, that is the problem.
Just real quickly, one thing you pointed out in this campaign, it's actually, so the U.S. and Israel have launched 1,000 sorties, air sorties, every day. Is that right? Which would actually put it more on par with the 1991 Gulf War in terms of...
That's right. This is now the most intense air campaign that America or the world has seen since the 1991 Gulf War. In the Gulf War, so in my book, Bombing to Win, I have all these statistics and so forth. So if people really want to check it out, they can go there. But in the first Gulf War, it was called Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. And we began with a 39-day air war where the peak of daily sorties, that's where an airplane takes off, drops bomb, the peak of daily sorties was 1,500. Well, here, it looks like it's hard to be 100% sure,
right,
but it looks like the peak has been 1,000 sorties a day. Now, you could even argue, as Secretary Hegseth did, and I think he's probably technically right, that this is even more intense than the 1991 Gulf War. It may be the most intense air war in history, air campaign in history. And the reason for that would be in 1991, only a fraction of those sorties carried precision weapons. It was not 100% precision. We are now virtually 100% precision force. So I do believe that when the stats all finally do come out and people like me can go through the reams and reams of stats we want to see to be sure, there's a good chance this will have been the most intense air campaign by any country in the precision age and may even beat out the 1991 Gulf War.
This also kind of reminds me of the 1999 Kosovo War. I mean, well, first of all, just to remind people, in the 1991 Gulf War, I think people might have forgotten, yeah, the air campaign went on for a long time. And it was thought at the time, even though, of course, the U.S. and the kind of coalition built up, it did build up a really large, credible ground force. But I think it was mostly thought that the air campaign would do it, and it didn't. But it just needed a very little push from the ground forces. But that kind
you've
of did
got, it. Yes, you're really describing it very well. So when I taught for the Air Force, I was teaching with the people who planned that air campaign. So I know this very, very, and this is laid out exquisite detail in the book. So the 1991 Gulf War began with a plan called Instant Thunder, which was a short 3-6-day air campaign to hit strategic targets. That's what these 1,500 sorties were that first week, in command bunkers, leadership bunkers, et cetera, Baghdad, around Baghdad, but nothing in the Kuwait theater of operation. Don't even touch the army in Kuwait. Well, the reason for that is because the air planners and also Schwarzkopf and also President Bush thought that air power alone might win. And so they gave it a full chance. And it didn't work. Sodom was not crushed. The regime didn't crumble after the first week. So they tried 39 days here. Eventually, they were bombing in Kuwait, thank goodness. That's the hammer and anvil effect. Mm-hmm. So they do basically come to the second strategy, the one that actually wins. And that's how you kick Saddam out of Kuwait. But then afterwards, there's an aftermath here in 91 that really is quite relevant to today. Mm-hmm. Because after that 39-day air war to collapse Saddam's regime, a 4-day ground war where the army in Kuwait, Saddam's army in Kuwait, is decimated, President Bush, this is the first President Bush, he called on the Shia in Iraq to rise up, much like the way President Bush has called on the pro-democracy forces
in
Iraq.
President Trump has.
Or President Trump. Yeah, yeah, apologies. We have so many similarities.
I know. a lot of similarities, yeah.
And what happened is, and the Shia were 40% of the Iraqi population. Saddam was a Sunni. That represented 20%. So you would think with all of that, the vulnerability of Iraq's regime could not be worse. Here, so you're hearing those arguments too. Mm-hmm. You know, Iran is so vulnerable, right? Well, what happened is the Shia rose up, and in 2 days, Saddam piled thousands of bodies in the street, just shot them all dead, or just large numbers of them dead. And we couldn't
the
do
Kurds
anything about
too
it.
In the north.
Before the no-fly.
You remember these, and these are very relevant to today. This isn't just ancient history. Yeah. Because, see, even though we were in Kuwait, had an army in Kuwait, you might say, well, look, we're only 100 miles away. Well, the cavalry can't get there in an hour. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's just, it doesn't work that way. You can't move all that force that fast. It takes, that's the issue with ground forces. It takes time. Logistics, water of all things. So you really are in a situation where they're on their own. So when President Trump is calling for these pro-democracy forces to rise up, there's, you know, he says he's got their back, but where is that in reality?
Yeah, and who would trust Trump's promises anyway?
Yeah. But this segues to something I think it was in your most recent Substack. Which is about how aerial bombing actually consolidates most regimes anyway. That it's in their it's natural, actually. And then I guess you back it up with data as well. But at least we can sort of understand why. Why do they act like this? Why do they go out in the streets and shoot down the Shia?
That's what I did this morning. I was up at 3 a.m. finishing this off because I was listening now to so many people quoting my top line that it has never worked. But then I realized, well, wait a minute, people need to understand more of the why.
Yeah.
And that's why I wrote that piece, and I wanted to get it out right away. And so what this piece does that's different is it really gets into the why. It shows you what actually fracturing regime would look like and why we're so far away from it. And the fundamental problem here is if you're going to fracture a regime, the people inside the regime, the insiders, they have to come to believe that they're better off fracturing the regime than staying together. And so when regimes fracture, they do fracture. But when you kill leaders with foreign air power, instead of, and even though the air power attacker will say, well, the next person, if you don't do my bidding, mm-hmm. I'm going to kill you too.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the full cost calculation for those insiders. You see, the insiders have two problems coming at them. Number one is they've got the foreign air power attacker saying they're going to get decapitated, but they've got their friends who've got guns and they can put bullets in the back of the head right away. The Brutus problem.
Yeah.
And that is much more dangerous than the air power.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump can think he's the most dangerous threat on the planet. And so a lot of people think that. But I guarantee you from inside here, once you see what this looks like inside, there's if you're looking at life expectancy, you do not extend your life by siding with Donald Trump in these situations. Yeah. Here. And so that's why what you end up with air power is you end up with two outcomes here. You end up outcome number one, where leaders are killed, but it's just a slight reshuffling of the deck chairs on the same regime. Mm-hmm. And the regime just basically goes about its business, and there's no actual regime change. Well, that's effectively what happened in Venezuela. Donald Trump said he was going to take all the oil. He said he was going to pump out all this massive amounts of oil. He said he was going to run the government. Mm-hmm. Well, the truth is he took one person out, and that regime, the Maduro regime, is there.
He took a trophy. Basically, he took a trophy.
He took a trophy. Yeah. He got a participation trophy, and he moved away and declared success. But there's no success. There's no strategic success, and that's why that is. It's option number two is what's happening now is where you radicalize the regime, mm-hmm. and they become far more aggressive. And this is what happened when Russia and the United States together in 1996 killed the Chechen leader Dudayev. It was a perfect kill.
Yes.
Clancy technology meets James Bond trickery. It's all in my Substack. It should be a movie.
Right? It was the cell phone. Yeah. It's the cell phone.
Yeah, and this is 1996.
Yes.
Okay. So really, you don't need to have pagers. And I mean, this was. Anyway, but what happened is that when Dudayev was killed, even with all this great tricks and all this other stuff, the new leader Baziev comes in, and he's a young buck. He's full of vigor, and he is the one who starts the suicide attack campaign against the Russians. He organizes the relatively small Chechen force, somewhere around just 10,000, mm-hmm. Up against 55,000 Russian troops in Chechnya itself. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're a 5-to-1 disadvantage, and they kick the Russians out in 3 months by the end of the summer.
Yeah. That seems like one of the big risks. And I'm sure there's a big literature about this in military history. The big risks in targeted assassination that you'll end up with somebody who's better, really.
Yeah.
Especially
a better
somebody
fighter.
Who's younger, closer to the combat experience of other lower commanders.
You've got it exactly, guys. Let me tie it back to Iran. So, you know, you're hearing about the Supreme Leader. Well, what you haven't heard much about on Fox or CNN, I mean, nobody, not in the New York Times or anybody, is who do you think signed the fatwa that Iran would not have a nuclear weapon?
Yeah.
Who do you think that
Khamenei,
was?
Khamenei, of course. Yeah.
Okay. The very guy who's now dead was, and I'm not trying to paint this as a good guy. I'm not supporting this guy or anything like that. So please don't look at it that way. But I am just trying to explain that there was a real debate, and it's probably now tilted the other side, of whether or not Iran should have a nuclear weapon within Iran. And there was a real religious fatwa saying, don't do that. Well, we're just taking away that entire top of the leadership that was on that side. So people are often describing this inside governments, and it's been going on for hundreds of years, that we're going to shift the balance between the hawks and the doves. So what we got to do here is we got to kill the hawks, mm-hmm. and we got to paralyze the hawks, and then the doves are going to come to the to the forefront. Well, we often don't even really understand who's the hawks and who's the doves. We're listening to expatriates here and taking their information. Well, there's a reason they're out of the country. okay. And then you're dealing with hints and flashes of information inside of the government. You're not really, this is not like a movie where you're watching the internal so closely. And to give you that another, I don't want to keep giving you historical case after historical case, but
we do a lot of historical wars on the show. So
let me pick one that's not air power. So in summer of 1941, Japan is thinking about launching a major attack on Pearl Harbor, and they decide not to do it. Yamamoto, the admiral, the leader in the Navy, said, no, don't do it. Bad things will happen. Well, then we slapped sanctions, oil sanctions on Japan. And for listeners that don't know, this isn't just a little bit of pressure here. This was going to crush the country's economy within about a year and a half because they're an island and they can't live without the their whole economy was turning on inflow. And with an island, you can seal it off. Right. Well, that flipped Yamamoto. So the reason Pearl Harbor happened was because of the sanctions. And we didn't even know that until after the surrender of Japan, where we end up getting all the documents here and we track it and we can see in real time exactly what happened. And right now we just don't have those documents for what's going on inside of Iran. We have intel, but intel is Swiss cheese. It's always Swiss cheese. It's got big holes in it. And, we just took out one of the key layers that was standing in the way of a nuclear weapon for Iran.
Yeah. You talk about their mosaic structure that they put into place, knowing that Israel and America, you know, one day would very likely try to decapitate them. And B, probably knowing also that because they've had hard experience in the last year, if not the last like 10, 15 years, about how well penetrated they are by the Israelis in particular. So they knew that some of these, that there were going to be deaths. Can you describe what this mosaic structure is and I don't know how it functions. Like, how does the mosaic structure function in terms of deciding what missiles are fired when and what drones are fired when?
That's right. So for your listeners, this is a standard strategy of the week. So if they kind of Google strategies of the week, they'll see people have been writing about different strategies of the week for a long period of time. And the reason is because when you go up against the 800-pound gorilla of the United States, you know, you are not an 800-pound gorilla. Who is, right? So you know going into this that you are weak. Then how are you gonna come out of this? What's this gonna really look like? Well, you're not gonna want to go toe to toe on the strength of the 800-pound gorilla.
Right.
That's only gonna make you lose even faster. Well, that's what we want. See, we want them to come and fight on our playing field, our best, so that we can win the quick and decisive victory. And And so forth. But the bad guys often just won't do that because they know, they've thought about this for some time. And so what they do is they look for ways to prepare for a long war. Since Vietnam in particular, in Vietnam, we never lost a battle and we lost the war badly. And why is that? It's because we were playing the escalation dominance game, just as we are here. And the other side was playing the long game. And that long game is drag this out as long as possible, as many costs as possible. And why? How are you going to win in the long game? The soft underbelly of America is the politics. It's our politics at home. The public at a certain point just gets fed up with being told that this is all going to work out great. And then they see in their own eyes, it's just not working out.
And this war wasn't even popular going into it, which is incredible. Yeah, so you're already starting.
It's really quite stunning. Yeah. That's exactly right. That you put your finger right on it. So what you end up with is then preparations for this. And since 1991, there have been lots and lots of countries who have studied, done their own reports of the Desert Storm, this 1991 campaign. I know listeners will think it's a very long time ago. Many of them wouldn't even have been born yet. It remains the actual test bed, the place where you cut your teeth on learning about the precision age. And that's not just true for Americans or history buffs. That's true if you're coming up the ranks in the military in Russia or China. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that I haven't seen it with Iran. I'm sure this is true with Iran. But you can go online and you will find online Russian military studies of the first Gulf War, Chinese military studies of the first Gulf War. So you could bet that has. Now, as part of that, what do you think they are shouting up and down? Be ready for your leaders to be attacked. Be ready for many of them to be killed. Because this is now the precision age. They see it. They're studying it in real time.
This is one of the oddest anomalies of the last few weeks. Khamenei was there at his compound in the capital, apparently having a meeting with people. And in a similar way, you know, Nasrallah was in his bunker waiting for the 10th or 100th bunker bomb, buster bomb to penetrate it. These leaders seem to have a death wish. I don't quite understand it. Why was Khamenei sitting there in the proverbial duck sense?
Well, look, I don't know what was in their particular heads, but I've advised every White House since 9/11. I've advised chiefs of staff of the Navy, the Air Force. That's Chief Naval Operations of the Navy. I have some more window into this, senators, congressmen, what I think people don't quite understand, especially if you're in your 20s and 30s, is that legacy matters a lot. Mm-hmm. Legacy matters a lot.
It really does. I always wonder that, and it's hard
for me. On the back end of your life. I don't think Donald Trump is joking when he says he wants to be on Mount Rushmore. He's 79 years old. Now, he may think he's got some magic elixir. But the fact of the matter is, these leaders, and this is true in all walks of life, they're often thinking about what is their legacy. Mm-hmm. Now, for ordinary people, the legacy might be how much they're leaving to their kids and their 401ks or things like that. These leaders have more opportunity to do more with their legacy. And that's what I think is often forgotten about. So you really are in a situation where how do you want to go out? Do you want to go out? Do you think you're really going to be there 10 years from now? Do you really think that if just because you missed this one bomb that you really are going to be evade Israeli intelligence, who's bribing everybody, with millions of dollars in order to get the eyeballs right on the leader. Mm-hmm. I think you just have to understand Donald Trump, he was two assassination attempts. Mm-hmm. I listened to him carefully talk about this more than maybe other people, because I listened with another lens. he says that only the great presidents are assassinated. He says that it's really, you are increasing the odds dramatically of assassination by being president. He didn't run away. He is understanding the fate that history may dealt him, and he is not running away from that. Mm. Now, maybe somebody else would. Other leaders, others may decide, no, it's not worth it to have themselves or their families killed. But I think we really just too quickly dismiss this idea. And then for the smart bomb trap, we run into it the other way, where we too quickly assume, oh, well, sure, just the bare, you know, 1 in 1,000 chance we'd kill you is enough to make you, become our puppet. Mm. Well, that doesn't really work in history very well. And I think these are the actual calculations going on.
I have a question about Kosovo War, and I know you've talked about it and written it about it too.
And interviewed everybody, yes, including Atasari in Finland and Helsinki, and Wesley Clark, including the planners in the Pentagon and also in the NSC. So I've only written up part of all my tapes. I have tape. I mean, oh my gosh, you know, just imagine how much I've been doing on this.
Interesting. I remember that war very well. I was in Russia, working in Russia at the time. So were you, John.
Oh,
we were
with there you go. Russia.
And, you know, we saw it from that angle.
Yeah, Strobe Talbot. I interviewed Strobe Talbot, who was in the Ministry of Defense. Yeah, keep going.
And my recollection of it, I haven't gone back through all my notes and articles and everything, but I saw you reference it in your pieces and your Substack. So is that... look, I've been to Kosovo. It's like a valley. It's a bowl, you know. And I think there were maybe 2 million people in this bowl, and you had all of NATO around it. And you know the difference in technology level between what the U.S. and its NATO allies had versus what the Serbs had was just massive. And they expected Milosevic. I think they presented Milosevic with basically a capitulation agreement in Rambouillet just before bombing. He said no, and then we bombed him and thought it was going to end, you know, a week of bombing and that'll be it. And it didn't work. And it went on and on. And I remember the frustration as the war went on, the frustration with Milosevic. And it did eventually end in NATO's favor about 2.5 months later. So it went, this was, you know, very advanced technology, precision strikes and so on from the air. There was, like, it was so massively unmatched. The Serbs could barely do anything about it, although they did shoot down an F-117, if I remember right, a stealth jet. But, you know, and ultimately when Milosevic did capitulate, it was really because the Russians sold them out and that because Yeltsin needed
and
our support.
And the ground forces, but you've
got... you're right. They did have an actual ground force they started to build up, and they were threatening it more and more. And then they also had the KLA kind of running around. But yeah, of course, because NATO's right there. It's almost kind of like the Nazis with the Dutch. Like, it's not like you had to go to the other side of the world, to the Gulf or something. You have all your forces right there. And so it was... And like I said, it's a pretty small area. So what lessons have been
Mark,
drawn from
Mark, you were
that?
There for several weeks, right?
And, about a year later,
Yeah, so this is one of the cases I didn't just study after the fact, but so let me just start with, so this starts in March, the third week in March, with what was supposed to be a three-day air campaign, hitting 51 targets in and around Belgrade. And just before that started, Milosevic, the leader of Serbia, met with our key diplomat, and the diplomat said, "You understand that if you do not accept," essentially, you said, "the surrender agreement, which is a pro-democracy idea to build up democracy in Kosovo, we're going to bomb you." And he said, "Yes, I understand. You will bomb me. You're going to hit my house. I know you're going to do that." Well, the three-day air campaign kicked off. We did bomb his house. Now, in that case, we didn't. We missed Milosevic himself, but we wrecked.
Were we aiming for him?
It's hard to know, but we did bomb his house.
Okay. Yeah. Well. Okay. So that's pretty good.
Just a lot of friendly gesture.
Bomb somebody's house where he sleeps at
night.
Okay. You can say, "Oh no, we're not." It's like Pete Hegseth saying, "We don't want regime change anymore."
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Okay. But then what happened is, so that's when I personally entered the picture. So what happened was I was teaching at Dartmouth. And just like you guys were, you know, calling up, well, I've been doing, you know, interviews forever on things. And ABC News with Peter Jennings, they call me up. I'm surprised. I'm just this young assistant professor, but I am, you know, somebody, the one doing all this work on air power and leadership decapitation. And so they bring me on, literally, the second day after that bombing. And I say, I give a big warning. I said, Milosevic is already responding by sending his 30,000 troops into Kosovo itself.
Right.
We have not positioned even our tactical air force in the region in order to confront this. So there's a good chance he's going to ethnically cleanse Kosovars from Kosovo. And then they brought on the national security advisor. And here I'm debating Sandy Berger. And, and he says, well, no, we couldn't possibly put another fighter. Professor Pape is wrong. And I say, no, this is not true. There are dozens and dozens of airfields in Europe we can use.
Right.
We need to take seriously that there is an ethnic cleansing campaign coming. Well, that's the disaster that happened. Yep. Because that exactly happened over the next several weeks
before
the cavalry
crisis.
Again. We keep thinking the cavalry is going to show up. Yeah. Well, it takes weeks to get there. Got to move a lot of stuff to do it. And by the time we move that Air Force in there, a million Kosovars are out of the country. Thousands and thousands are killed in this ethnic cleansing campaign. Now, then this does go on for months, 78 days. And what happens at the end is that you have the ground offensive mounting here where there's suddenly Bill Clinton is really now understood. He's going to have to accept that if you're going to bomb to win, you're going to have to use air power and ground power together. And much like getting Kuwait, by the way, it was a very similar hammer and anvil plan. And this is what they are discussing with Adesari. There are maps and so forth. What's going to happen with the ground offensive? This is what Milosevic is facing. And so much the way Saddam is essentially conceding Kuwait early, Milosevic is doing very similar things. So it's actually, it's the more you get into the details, it's you can really sort of understand how the became a disaster and then why after 78 days it stopped. But this was a real wound for NATO. This is where NATO really is wounded in major, major ways. This was the wound that would not heal. Because after all, this was a disaster. And it's and I worry that what we're doing right now with these Gulf Arab states is we are producing wounds that will take a long time to heal.
Wait, how was it a wound for NATO? Because I thought
it bound became them so together. Clear we were reckless with so we are in with NATO. We have not just great power, great coordination, but great responsibility. I mean, NATO's putting the security of NATO and Kosovo, this is a European theater. This is not a theater somewhere very far away.
Well, I know that it radicalized Russians in a way that nothing in the 1990s did.
Really
radicalized Russians.
For
them set the precedent for why they could take Crimea. Ukraine war is another story, but that sort of gave them their rationalization. Well,
and also think about going back to Chechnya. So again, you've got Putin on the rise here as national security advisor inside of Russia. This is 1999.
FSB head, yeah.
The FSB. And so what's happening in this situation is you are creating... you're changing the calculations. This is this point I make about the smart bomb trap. It's not just putting bombs on targets, it's changing politics. Mm-hmm. And it's changing politics and incentives for actors in ways that are often diametrically opposed to our interests. And this is the part of the loss of control of the escalation dynamic.
Yes.
And that's what you saw with Russia. So this was really quite a pivotal case here for what comes later.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of traps, let's talk about the trap that we're in, that developed, that you pretty much predicted, that we're in right now. Could you describe the trap? Because you can see this getting out of control.
So this is why I started the Escalation Trap Substack. I've been thinking about this for a while, actually, but I realized watching the Air Armada essentially form, and on X, I was explaining how this was happening. I had my first 7.5 million tweet X post. It was really something to see because it was a post that really explained how big of a force we were building. Well, that also told me that it was highly unlikely we were doing all that buildup with especially the logistics we were moving, mm-hmm. and we were just going to do nothing. This very, very unlikely. Never know for sure what a president's going to do until he does it, but still. So that's when I decided to start the Substack, the Escalation Trap, and explain the stages of Escalation Trap in general, the Smart Bomb Trap in particular. And we are now in stage two. So stage one is where we have bombed the targets with 100% precision. Now we're in this early part of stage two where we've changed politics inside of the target regime and the target society. And before we had stage two, before we did the bombing, we're on this now change of politics. If you could imagine, and many other journalists in the world was talking about, the society of Iran versus its leadership. Mm. Well, once we bomb in this way, America now is a third actor, yeah. and it's the dominant actor. Yeah. It's no longer a two-actor game, society versus regime. It's now a three-actor game where America has come in. And what that does is it infuses nationalism, which is over and above religion, but nationalism into the equation in the regime and the society together and creates more bonds. And it creates bonds against the Americans. And what does that do? That then is what lays the political foundation for more risky strategies. That is the strategy you just saw, the retaliation strategy by Iran, is not something that was probably on the bingo card of the Pentagon. They said as much. And why would that be? Because intel, it's literally not there. Okay. But it forms pretty quick because now what you're seeing is a different risk calculus. For part of the regime, the risk calculus is literally brutal survival. Because 1 in 8 adults in Iran, of 92 million people overall, 1 in 8 adults works for the regime. Over a million to have arms for the regime. That's a lot of people with weapons. And thousands and thousands are political leaders for the regime. So this is really quite if there is a regime change, there's going to be a lot of payback here for all of those groups, and they know it. So that's the survival aspect. But then you have the nationalism aspect, and that's going to affect even the moderates or even part of the pro-democracy part, which is, well, now you've gone from being sort of Thomas Jefferson, so to speak, mm-hmm. independence, to now you're just an appendage of the French.
That was the death of the Mujahideen-e Khalq, when they actually served with the Iraqis. I've read, I can't verify this, that was the end for Iranian support. No one would go near them after that.
It certainly sounds right. I don't know that case, but it's but what you are seeing here is the intrusion of the third party, the West, the foreign occupier, the United States, part of toppling Mossadegh in 1953. Mossadegh is essentially democracy, and that's not good enough for us because they might side, that democratic Iran might side with the Soviet Union, so we don't want to take the risk. Democracy is not only good when it works for us, right? Yeah. And then we install the Shah of Iran. Well, that goes on till 1979, as we all know. And then you can't even control that because when the Shah's falling, at first, this was sort of loved by liberals in the West. There's a liberal whose name is Foucault, who we teach at the University of Chicago, Discipline and Punish. Some of your listeners will have had read Foucault in class.
Yeah, sure.
Well, he went to Iran and he's published a whole set of dispatches from Iran, glowing optimism about what was coming because he thought the Iranian people were rising up, pro-democracy, overthrow the occupier and so forth. And then what happens is the real bad guys come, and that's who Khomeini is and his folks. They're just much more vicious, much more vicious. And Foucault actually published a book afterwards, if you're interested in this, where he really quite honestly keeps all his old dispatches and then all the ones as things are changing and the reality comes into him. And it's stunning to watch the changes in Foucault. Because you just can't control these outcomes. And usually when you have fractures in regimes, bad things happen. Bad things happen. It's not always the case, but bad things happen. And that's what happened in 1979. So anyway, that's just a long
definitely
story.
Definitely bad for liberals, that's for sure.
It's not very good because you end up with the guys with the guns usually end up getting the power.
Contra that, there was a V.S. Naipaul's writing. He went... At the same time, and Naipaul's a very different character, a different writer than Foucault, and he spent a lot of time with the kind of idealistic left wing. Now I can't remember the name of that group, but Naipaul's a reactionary. I mean, a brilliant guy and a reactionary, so he saw things kind of in a much colder way than somebody like Foucault might have, but. Yeah, so right now though we're in a situation where the decapitation precision strikes worked, killed a lot of top people, that it has changed nothing. I mean, even the 12-day war, the initial Israeli strike in the 12-day war caused a lot more initial paralysis. As far as I can tell, I mean, in the first sort of 24, 48 hours, the Iranians barely responded.
I think that's probably fair because they were caught by surprise. They thought they were not expecting that during the midst of negotiations, the bombs would fall. We would kill, assassinate, murder the diplomats who were doing the negotiation. And they noticed that they've weren't.
Yeah. And so this time around, without Khamenei, the leader. Nevertheless, everything has functioned according to plan. And it's been, I'd like to hear, I don't know if you know more on this, but it seemed pretty clear to me as well. Like, I don't think the U.S. and Israel, or maybe Israel did know and didn't tell us, but I don't think the U.S. really expected the Iranians to, A, have the capacity to light the region on fire, and B, they probably didn't expect because the Iranians had always responded by trying to de-escalate because they are weaker. And previously had tried to de-escalate that the Americans, maybe the Israelis as well, took that. They misunderstood that or misinterpreted that as general weakness and a inability to really do anything. But instead, what we have is havoc in, you know, if not the most important, you know, one of the two or three most important choke points to the global economy in the whole world right now.
Your description is right. So this is a catastrophic failure. This isn't just the, you know, sort of, well, we bombed and not too much happened and we're moving on. What you are seeing are things are being set in motion like an oil tanker moving. And that's why the markets are dropping. People aren't losing money just to lose money. They definitely see which way the wind is blowing. I don't think that, this was really factored in. Now, I don't know for sure, as haven't interviewed all those folks yet.
Right.
Maybe I never will this time. I don't know, but I've done this many times before, actually interviewed the people in depth. And they're just literally, their focus is not on this. They're just missing the outcomes. In the case of Kosovo, I spoke with the NSC person. I'm not going to say enough about to be able to identify the person, who was the actual person at the top of the group with the 400-page top secret PowerPoint explaining the worst cases to President Clinton himself. And I saw somebody, when you do that, you can show people. I didn't have a clearance at the time, but they can still do that. So it's not, nobody's getting in trouble. But the fact of the matter is, the actual Serbian response was nowhere near to be seen on
really
400 page deck, not even a glimmer of it. And I think this is what you end up with the smart bomb trap. You're literally mesmerized by the idea of your own power, and you're working very hard. It's not that you're not working 18 hours. You're not going to parties or something. You're working very, very hard, but you're not incentivized to see it from the other side. It's more the opposite, because you think you're in full control and anything they do must be stupid or must be going to fail. But that has happened over and over and over again. And that's what you see here. How much we anticipated, if there was some intelligence we ignored, I'm sure this will eventually come out. Mm-hmm. I think there's just a very good chance what I'm saying, that was just simply the blinders of the smart bomb trapping yet again. And the and we don't know the full amount of the blinders. Now, we are activating the FBI. Cash Patel is telling the JTTFs, who I've worked with for many, many years, to start focusing on terrorist attacks inside the United States. But we also have to remember, we've gutted the international counterterrorism components of our government over the last year since President Trump has come back into office. I mean, literally gutted them.
To go after migrants, many things,
but not international terrorism. And so you end up with a situation where, okay, over a period of 6-8 months, maybe a year, you can rebuild some of that capacity. But once you gut capacity this way, this is not a light switch you just throw back on. Right. Again, people, I think, don't quite understand. This is not just President Trump calls, picks up the phone, and the cavalry is there the next hour.
Yeah.
That's not how this works in the real world. And that's the real set of issues that we face right now, which is we really are in an uncertain escalation trap. There's really quite a bit of initiative that Iran is demonstrating, and they still have a big card that has not really been played yet is international terrorism.
Yeah, that really struck me too. I mean, they've moved away from that, and with pretty spectacular results in their latest air attacks. But it's still there, I would imagine. Yeah. I mean, the Revolutionary Guard is still there.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just with the Revolutionary Guard. I mean, just remember, we have been peppered with lots of stories in the press about the Iranian plots inside the United States to assassinate President Trump. And President Trump bragged yesterday that he got the Supreme Leader before the Supreme Leader got him. So there's probably a lot more that President Trump knows about those plots.
Yeah, that's true.
And so the fact is that the biggest embassy here for Iran is in Mexico. Mm. Lots of cartels are in Mexico. Right. What exactly came across the border before President Trump came back into office? And again, there would have been months between time he was elected and he actually came back into office. So there's a lot of things we don't know about possible capabilities. Now, I'm not trying to say I know either. I'm just trying to point out that this is part of when we talk about the future here. These are the issues that have yet to unfold. So as this, and the final thing to say is that we still have no idea where any of that enriched uranium is. Mm-hmm. 1,000 pounds of 60%, 10,000 pounds of 5% and 20%. And imagine if just small amounts of that are sprinkled on the warheads of the next drone attacks going into Riyadh.
Yeah.
You don't need to be a rocket scientist to start thinking of, I mean, you have to put yourself a little bit in the shoes of the other side.
Yes.
What kind of options might they have? And we keep saying, well, what don't they have?
Right.
When they do Mosaic, they don't have that decentralized cellular structure, the option for what's called a combined arms operation, where they combine their Army, Air Force, and Navy into a toe-to-toe pitched conventional battle, to say, take Basra, for example. or to take some territory, some other territory in, say, Saudi Arabia. That was really never in the offing. So they, right, they don't have that, that they have been weakened in that way. But what they do have is plenty of capability to remain in symbolic control, which is really quite powerful control of an authoritarian country, because they have their coercive apparatus intact. It can murder and kill large numbers of civilians. They have that suppression capability here virtually intact. Those security forces are not decimated. And they also have the ability for the dispersed and modestly coordinated, but selectively able to be focused retaliation with drones. There may well be mining capability here, yes, that is still, yeah, not yet been something we can really take off the table. And with mines in the Persian Gulf here, yeah, you don't have to sow thousands and thousands of mines. All you've got to do is pretty much what they've done now is threaten, blow up a tanker, hit a few tankers, and suddenly those tankers, they're not there for lead, they're bullets, they're there for paychecks.
Yeah.
You're going to have a hard time getting people to say, oh, sure, I'm going to go and, you know, be risking my whole life to get the oil through the Straits of Hormuz. Really? Is that really going to happen? Yeah. This is the reality of the real world.
Right. I want to let you go. You've been with us for a long time, and I really appreciate it, but I do just kind of have a final question for you going forward. I mean, it seems to me it comes down to the Iranian strategy is to outlast, is to stay in the battle, and that is how they win. Whereas the Americans, what they need to, as in all these other wars, they need to keep escalating up to ground. If the Iranians stay in and are still able to hit the Gulf neighbors and cause havoc in the Straits of Hormuz and perhaps even set off some kind of suicide bomb somewhere in Europe or the U.S. Like, I mean, the Iranians need to do less, as difficult as it is to stay in it, but the Americans, I would think, will think they need to do more. Is that right?
That's what I'm expecting in the second stage of the smart bomb trap, which is the Americans double down with escalation dominance. The other side, though, takes advantage of the weapons of the weak, and you've just laid them out. And then the real wild card here, which is more up for grabs, I think, than people realize, are the positions of the Gulf states. And things we don't know, which is, well, just how willing would the security forces of the Gulf states be to turn on their own leaders? We saw with Sadat, he was assassinated by his own security detail. Because he cut a deal with Israel. And I'm sure Sadat wasn't expecting to die that day. Yeah. So the idea that your own security forces, you're absolutely sure, the loyalty here is really, really in flux across the region. That's because are you going to be part of the campaign for Israeli hegemony now?
Exactly.
That's right. Now you're, you know, you see, and this is what's being presented to the Iranians are going to do a lot to make sure it's quite clear that this is a campaign. And I'm not saying it's even true.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at this from the enemy side. And they've got golden propaganda cards to play here to shift the loyalties of the Gulf states. And so, okay, are you really up for being the henchman of not just Donald Trump, but Netanyahu? And you're going to help Netanyahu become the new hegemon here?
I got to say, that seems so crazy to me. I understand why, I guess, Trump... No, I can't say I understand it. I mean, obviously, the Israelis have an enormous amount of capacity and intelligence, and so that would help them. But if you think about the politics of a war you're going to get into, I can't imagine anything more stupid than leading with the Israelis on an Islamic theocracy.
And also just imagine coming up all with this these ideas on the fly, essentially.
Yes.
Maybe there are some ideas that have been like planned for months in advance. I'm not, you know, the Pentagon's constantly doing war plans, but that's not the same thing as actually getting ready for the actual conflict. So it's hard to, but this is the problem we face. The smart bomb trap is seductive, as we started with.
Yeah.
And then it narrows the field of vision. And then people keep looking, how could they get in this position? Well, we've been asking that question a lot in the Smart Palm Age.
Yeah.
It's been a very fulsome conversation. It's been really wonderful. Thank you for being so thoughtful and so really to get into so much here. That's why I did the escalation trap. I believe we need these thicker discussions.
Yes, yes.
And this
thank
has
you.
Really been terrific.
Well, thank you so much,
Thanks very much.
Robert Pape. And definitely we'll post links to it. Check out, subscribe to his Substack, The Escalation Trap. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Bye-bye. Great pleasure. Bye now.
Bye. Okay. That was our interview with Professor Robert Pape from the University of Chicago. Again, check out his Substack, The Escalation Trap, which he seems to be, I think, updating daily or close to daily following the Iran, the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. So thank you again to Robert Pape, and thanks, John, Brendan, and everyone. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.